The following podcast may contain views and opinions not held by AnimeNewsNetwork.com. Viewer discretion is advised.
Hey everybody, welcome to AnCast. I'm Zach Burgee. Everyone's super busy this last weekend of September. We've got the preview guide coming up. Justin's swamped with video stuff. And so this week we don't have a first segment, but we did do a call-out show. So we're just going to get straight to that and let other people talk for a change. So yeah, let's get right to it. All right. First up, joining us today is Yukena Kemma, who is in the Navy, right?
Yes, sir.
Which is awesome. What's your rank again?
Seaman, E3.
Awesome. Okay, cool. So, well, thanks for joining us. Justin's not here for this segment. What's on your mind, dude?
Well, right now, it's funny. One thing I really notice a lot of anime fans get flame wars over is the idea of military realism. Like some Gundam fans say, oh, look, our show is the most realistic thing ever. And Voltam fans go, no, our show is so gritty and realistic. It's like, we so gritty and realistic. But I've lived it.
Right.
And now I can like say, what are you people talking about?
So is the issue that none of that shit is realistic at all?
Pretty much.
Well, when it comes to protocol and stuff, I mean, obviously it's a fantasy scenario, but are they getting even the little military details wrong? I mean, these are shows made by a country that effectively doesn't have a military.
Yes, we are their military.
Right.
Yeah, but some shows, I mean, LOGH, I've seen they managed to get some of the protocols right, but they're both unique.
Right.
But in general, the closest thing I've seen to probably realism is maybe some of the Gundams series, but in general, I've noticed everyone is so unprofessional it hurts.
Well, let's get some examples. Name some of the most like egregious examples you've seen.
Egregious examples. In the original Mobile Suit Gundam series, there's a character named Bright, and he's physically abusive. He slaps his junior enlisted around. Now, of course, that would not go well at all. People have been fired for a lot less.
Hmm.
Yeah.
So, I mean, Gundam is not particularly realistic. Have you ever seen something where you said, okay, they're getting the details right?
One thing, bizarrely enough, I saw where they were getting the details right? I'd probably say one of the things Legend of Galactic Heroes, when Wang and like the bunch of the main characters are leaving to go to the fleet, the fact that they actually managed to show the soldiers at the airport, casually talking, in uniform, leaving. That's the first time I've ever actually seen people realistically coming back from leave.
Interesting. Yeah, I know nothing about any of this stuff, so this is all totally news to me. But one thing I have noticed, you know, when I do watch something that's set in a military environment like a Gundam or a Legend of the Galactic Heroes, the military protocol and stuff, I don't know, it never seems like it's really that important to the story. Is this something you really only pick up on when you do have the personal experience?
Yeah, it's weird. It's like the little things that's like, where's the, like, sometimes it's like, where are the initial salutes or whatnot? Or like, why isn't everyone calling themselves? Why are some of these people have talking with their first names? We can't do that.
Right. So that stuff must just suddenly pop out to you once you're super familiar with,
with the protocol. It's the scariest thing is one little show I recently bought. It's old, Starship Operators. I actually was like, they got this right. It's a show about a bunch of military cadets who, through magical anime circumstances, have to run their own battleship. And I'm like, what? This is, wow, this is actually pretty much what we did. Yeah, they got battle stations right. That was like that was the most impressive example I've seen of, yeah.
So, as an anime fan who's in the military, do you gravitate towards shows that are set in the military, or do you look for more escapist stuff?
Honestly, at this point, I look for things that are like anti. It's like, oh no, I don't want to see Chief again. Like, honestly, at this point, I pretty much started looking for the anti-military shows at this point. Not like anti-war, but like just things that are different.
Right. So you're not necessarily going for the Gundams and stuff like that.
Yeah.
So with the fans online, you mentioned it's sort of irritating to see anime fans fighting about, you know, whose show has the biggest e-penis in terms of military realism. What would you suggest to them in terms of getting educated about this so that they're not just sort of arguing stuff they made up?
I would honestly say just look up basic your Blue Jackets manual. That's pretty much what for like your average enlisted. That's pretty much what your Bible is. Like little things like that. Just look up your basic combat manual and pretty much don't be deceived by like as much of this fancy things look fancy. Oh God, you don't want to be on the other end of them.
I'm not sure what you mean.
Like one thing I hear sci-fi shows in general talk about, oh no, the fancy nuclear engine and it's so cool. Well, that's my job. Mm-hmm. It's not cool. It's horrible. It's imagine being you know what a plumber is, right?
Yeah.
Imagine being a super plumber. It's pretty much being a super plumber.
Interesting. So it's not when they make the tech look glamorous, it's really not.
We're all pretty much super plumbers or super electricians.
Wow, interesting. Okay, so I assume you were a fan before you enlisted?
Mm-hmm.
What are a lot of your peers into this stuff, into anime, or are you sort of the only fan?
Surprisingly, yeah, but I think it's my peer group is, well, we're an odd group because it's like we're a bunch of nerds,
right?
Yeah. So it's like, yeah, it's pretty bad sometimes, though.
What do you mean?
Like, one thing I was like, I was asking someone sort of some help with this quiz, and it's like, hey, what's up? Hey, watch this. And it's like, imagine like 20 guys around a TV watching, say, like Bleach or something. Like, it's like you've seen 2001. It's like the monkey and the monolith.
Right.
That same image.
Well, I mean, you guys wind up having a lot of time to kill, right?
It's like half of our job is like we're up, then we're up for half the day, well, a quarter, then we have nothing to do, and then it's the actual work, which is like we're pretty occupied. So yeah.
And anime is a pretty good way to fill that.
Yep.
Fill that time in. Yeah, I can imagine. What do the other guys gravitate towards? Do you all pretty much like the same kind of stuff, or I mean, what's the
it's
most popular?
A lot of people like a lot of action things, like the Bleach and Naruto is ridiculously popular. What else? Berserk I know is pretty popular, and I know manga wise, I'd say more of like the darker titles, like what does Vertical release? Trying to remember, but yeah, pretty much
like a Blackjack or stuff like that.
Yeah,
cool, interesting. I didn't know. I mean, I've heard tell that anime was fairly popular among people in the military just because there's so much of it. It's, you know, you can get it pretty easily, and it doesn't count as contraband, does it?
No, except for if it's porn. Except for if your chief doesn't like you.
Oh, okay, that's cool. So go ahead.
It's like, it's funny too, because there's almost a network, because a bunch of us get stationed in Japan. So it's like pretty much like, here, give me money, we import this for me, or you're going to Japan, buy this for me. It's hilarious.
That's cool. Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, before we wrap up, have you been watching anything lately? What have you been into lately?
What have I been into lately? The most recent title I really liked. I actually finally started watching Night Raid.
Night Raid. Now, that's a very controversial show.
Mm-hmm.
Because of the obvious Japanese people making a show about their agents in China.
Yes.
Which is and not
I was subject. Like, this is going to be interesting, yeah.
Although I heard after a while, like, it just kind of falls off. People really lost interest in that show really quick.
Yeah, I only watched it because I was like, I wanted to have an opinion on it. I don't want to be one of those guys who's like, oh, I say this. And I'm like, I need to watch it before I can have an opinion on it.
Right. Which is rare nowadays.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, buddy. Well, listen, thank you so much for coming on and enlightening us. And, of course, you know, thank you for your service to our country.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, man. Okay, talking to us now is Daniela Orihuela Gruber, manga editor and blogger at manga allaboutmanga.net, And you're also a freelance manga editor for, is it Tokyopop?
Yes, Tokyopop, and I have a Korean company that I'm working in right now that is going to debut their product in October called iCTune.
Interesting. So, well, let's start at the top. I think a lot of people would be curious to know how you exactly get a gig editing manga. How did that come about?
July, I started an internship at Tokyopop for an editorial internship, and I completed that, went back to school for a quarter, and then asked them if I could intern again. And both of those times, butt off, like seriously so hard. I didn't take any other jobs. I was there like full time, and I just did everything that I could for them. And that's essentially how I got the job.
And this is a paid position. You're not an intern anymore.
No, I'm not an intern anymore.
Now, I got to ask briefly. I am under the impression that Tokyopop has their interns doing a lot of stuff, more so than you'd see at a lot of other publishing companies.
Well, having never interned at another publishing company, I couldn't really tell you, but...
Well, let me put it... I'll share my anecdote. A buddy of mine was an intern at Tokyopop, and they had him doing cover design. Which, that's a pretty big deal for an intern to do, and I was shocked that they would have an intern doing cover design. In terms of your duties as an intern, were you doing, like, final edit, final pass, stuff like that?
Not usually, until after they decided they wanted to hire me as a freelancer. I mostly just did copy edits and worked on their newsletter, which goes out every week. Things like that. I did a lot of research for them. I tried to contribute during acquisitions meetings, things like that. So, I mean, I guess in retrospect, I wasn't doing anything extremely serious, but I'm pretty sure that even the interns who were doing cover designs and whatnot for the design internship were, you know, they were looked over by a more senior member of the staff and, you know, maybe made a few tweaks here and there.
Right. Interesting. Okay. So, so basically you worked your butt off as an intern, and that turned into a freelance gig, not a full-time gig.
Not a full-time gig.
Interesting.
Unfortunately.
Okay. Right. Well, I mean, you know, in this environment, I don't think anybody's really hiring
full-time.
Trust me,
I feel pretty lucky to even have a freelance gig doing something I love. So
yeah, totally. So tell us a little bit about what exactly it is your process is. From start to finish, what do you do exactly as an editor?
Well, we kind of start off with, I get the script from the translator or the adapter, you know, whoever's working on it last. And then I do edits to it. I make sure everything's kind of flowing right. There's nothing missing. You know, do we want this to be bolded? Do we want it to be italicized? And make sure, you know, we have the correct font choice in certain areas. Like if something is, you know, a sound effect or a comment that's not in a word bubble or some sort of stuff, we pick and choose fonts based on what we want. And then we send it off to the letterers, get it back from the letterers. We start doing copy edits and copy edits and copy edits. And then it gets copy edited by other people. I also write the back cover copy, so, you know, all the stuff that you see on the back of books, and preview copy for the next volume of manga, where there is a next volume of manga. Sometimes that can be a little difficult, because I've had a few series where the manga next volume wasn't even published in Japan yet, and I'm just like, huh, I have to write preview copy. Let's see how I can work this. We approve the final cover designs and try to, like, make tweaks to them where necessary. Like, I can say to the designers, I guess, if I wanted to, I don't like this color, can we not use pink? Or, you know, this number is off center, could you make it more on center, something, you know? And then we just, you know, make sure everything is as perfect as it can be. All the ISBN numbers in place, copyright languages in place, all that sort of stuff, and send it off to print.
And what are you using to do this in? What programs are you using?
Well, I mean, a lot of it's, at least at Tokyopop, is still done on paper.
Okay.
I mean, I just use, for the scripts, I use a basic Word editing program, you know, Word, whatever else. For reviewing the final copies of the script, we usually use Adobe Reader. Just the internet sometimes, right. I guess.
Okay. So you're not exactly opening up, you know, Illustrator, InDesign documents or anything like that.
No.
Yeah, okay. Interesting. That's what I wanted to know. Interesting. Okay. So what are some of the biggest challenges? What are some of the titles you're working on, and what are some of the biggest challenges with those?
Hetalia. I was a script editor for Hetalia, and that was a pretty big challenge just because it's very busy.
Yeah.
And I've had that issue with a lot of other manga that I've worked on, like Sergeant Frog, and Zone Zero Zero. There's a lot of stuff crammed in there. You've got little asides and sound effects and things everywhere, and you're just looking through the script. You know, like when you're working on a script, you've got the Japanese book next to you, so you're looking through it and going, huh, you know, like, did I get everything in this panel? You know, am I missing something? And it's just a sea of ink and letters, and you're just like, oh, what am I doing? You know, did I really have everything, you know, like, did I miss something? It can get crazy.
Right, exactly. Now, it sounds like you get stuck with a lot of gag manga, which that's got to be harder to do than your standard shoujo romance or whatever. Like, the comedy translating is really tough, to my knowledge.
I guess so. I kind of feel like I don't know. I haven't had the worst problems, or maybe the comedy in the manga that I worked on just appeals to me. So, you know, I just try to let the jokes shine through unless there's a huge, like, cultural difference between Japan and the U.S. that just doesn't make sense unless I tweak it somehow.
Right, exactly. And how often do you find yourself doing that? I mean, do you do a lot of rewriting, or you guys are pretty faithful?
Well, there's always a little bit of rewriting in every single script that I do, but in terms of tweaking, like, the best example I have is I did the latest volume of Lagoon Engine, and there was a card game in the middle of this manga that is probably nothing that most manga fans have ever heard of before. And we were using all these terms for the card games, or at least the rewriter was, and I just kind of inserted little explanations into every single new term that came about, and was just like, okay, this is the reading card, and this is the pickup card. But after the first time I did that, I didn't explain them again, and I just let them be.
Right. Interesting. That's really interesting. So what are some of your pet peeves? Anything that pops up that you just can't stand dealing with?
Let's see. One of the most annoying things I think I've had in terms of getting something back from the rewriter is probably when they, like, put a lot of extra spaces between stuff in the script, thus making my script about 5 pages longer than it was really supposed to be.
Mm-hmm.
I've gotten a few that kept in, like, the little tilde symbol for everything, and I don't like that tilde symbol. So I always tried to delete it, and it caused me a lot of problems in Sergeant Frog because I kind of forgot about it.
Mm-hmm.
And then so, you know, copy editing Sergeant Frog, there's tildes everywhere. Oh, delete, 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 delete. And then sound effects. There's a lot of sound effects from Japanese that don't really make much sense in English. You know, you're just kind of like, what is that supposed to be?
Yeah.
And I don't know. I just find them, like, I'd rather change them to something that's easier to understand from an American perspective than something that's easier to understand from a super fan's perspective, if you know what I mean.
Well, yeah, the Japanese are big fans of weird-ass onomatopoeia. Like, they have onomatopoeia for everything, and it's
yeah.
Very, very different from an American sensibility. So, aside from that, you do some manga blogging. Now, so, are you concerned at all about there being a mild conflict of interest? Do you just not review Tokyopop titles now?
I do not review Tokyopop titles, strictly speaking. I have put up a post or here or there about a certain Tokyopop title or not. I did for Hitalia put up a long list of why you should read this manga, but not just because I worked on it and because it's now one of my babies. Mm-hmm. It's just that I think it gets a lot of bad rap from people who are not fans, who have never read the manga. They just see the people screaming in the hallways, getting really excited about Hitalia. And I think they just don't realize that there's some really good stuff behind Hitalia. And I mean, I wasn't a hater before I started working on it, but I was kind of ambivalent about it. You know, I figured, oh, well, you know, maybe I'll get to it someday. And then I got to work on it, and I was just like, holy shit, this is amazing. So I had to write it because I think there's probably plenty of people out there with that opinion.
Right. Well, I mean, there's a reason it's so popular. You know, it's it's not that insanely popular because it sucks.
Exactly.
That's interesting. So, but at the same time, like, even posting that, you have to sort of feel a little bit like, well, you know, maybe I shouldn't, because I was paid to work on this, and the blog is the ideal of the blog is that it's objective, and you know.
Actually, No.
Okay.
Not my blog. It's pretty much I figured out now that my strong point is voicing my opinions about stuff, so that means it's not very objective at all.
Well, what I mean by objective is you're untainted by you know, being paid by the company that is producing this thing.
Well, yeah. I mean, I do try to, like, when I post that kind of stuff, I do try to you know, be clear to my readers that, yes, I worked on this. I'm not coming from a point where I'm totally unbiased. So every instance of that kind of thing is just like, yeah, well, you know, I'm going to be clear with you guys.
Okay, well, that's probably a good approach. And I would imagine, you know, your readers probably appreciate hearing from somebody who actually has their foot in the door and actually works at, you know, freelance for a manga company.
Yeah, and to be honest, I mean, not that this is any fault of Tokyopop's. They didn't pay me that much. So,
right.
I mean, I'm pretty much just promoting it on my own because I love it.
That's cool. That's cool. I can understand that. So, what else have you been reading lately? What's on your radar right now? What's good out there?
Oh, gosh. I've got a lot of stuff in my reading list. I just finished earlier the first volume of Teru Teru Shonen, which is a CMX title that will sadly, if it's not already out of print, it will be very, very soon.
Mm-hmm.
Let's see, what else have I been reading? I read the 14th Dalai Lama manga that I recently reviewed on my blog. That was a good one. I like that one. I really like Buddhism and history and all sorts of stuff like that. And it was about, pretty much, it didn't focus on like this long string of events that occurred over the Dalai Lama's very long life. It was mostly focused on what happened when China invaded Tibet and took it under their government, and what happened to the Dalai Lama. So basically the reason why he's so famous to begin with. And it, you know, it was pretty good. I didn't know that much about what happened to him before that, and I think it gave me a very clear understanding without presenting it to me like some boring montage. Instead, it was, you know, the Dalai Lama's story itself. So that was a nice one.
Cool. And anything else out there? Or, I mean, in terms of like maybe something people can actually find on a shelf.
Well, that one just came out.
Oh, okay.
Today, actually.
Interesting. I had no. I thought CMX was totally finished.
Oh well, CMX is finished, but that one was from Penguin.
Oh, okay.
The Dalai Lama one. My boyfriend and I just picked up a copy of Coco Be Good, which is not manga, but it's a webcomic or something similar. It was a webcomic being published by First Second. And I've got a huge bookshelf right now of stuff that I'm either in the process of reading or trying to read. So Cat-Eyed Boy, I guess. I'm looking forward to reading that one because I don't usually read horror manga except for Kurosaki Corpse Delivery Service.
Right. Interesting. Yeah, I've just been sort of perusing the horror manga myself. There's a lot of really weird stuff going on in that genre. Okay, well, thanks a lot for talking to us. Your blog is allaboutmanga.net, right?
Yes. I recently did a post on prostitution in manga, so I had a lot of readers contribute to that one, and it's been a very interesting topic to research.
Awesome. Well, people can definitely should definitely go check that out. I will be checking that out myself. Thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Okay, joining me now is not really I think most known manga blogger out there, president and founder of Yuricon and ALC Publishing, Erica Friedman. How's it going?
Nice to be here. Thank you very much for having me. Hello, everybody who's listening.
Right, no problem. So we've been meaning to have you on for a little while now. You're a personality in the manga blogging community, I would say. But you're very specifically, your focus is Yuri, which I think is a misunderstood genre, and certainly not as popular as its counterpart, Yaoi, I would say, in terms of American readers. So how'd you get your start with the whole blogging thing? What spurned you to get as vocal about it as you are?
I started Okazu in 2002. We were planning YuriCon 2003. And when I went out online at the time looking for, you know, all of the how-tos to do an event, a lot of the information was really basic and really kind of dumbed down. And I thought, well, you know, there's a lot of stuff that goes on in the background that fans just don't know. So I started writing about that as I was, you know, dealing with guests and dealing with vendors and dealing with everything. And then, of course, I was promoting the event. And then, 2003 came and went. We did our event. It was awesome. And you know, it dawned on me that really at the time there were no other, in 2002, there were no other Yuri blogs of any kind. There weren't any in Japan, there weren't any in America, there weren't any. So I just started, in between talking about the event, I started talking about Yuri anime and manga. there's something that a lot of Yuri fans have noticed. We don't really know why this happens, but an odd number of years, Yuri sort of shifts up for some reason. There's a bump up, either there's a popular anime or two, or there's a popular manga or two, and in 2003, a Japanese magazine called Yuri Shimai started, and we were doing our event, and we started our publishing in 2003. So in 2003, there was like this big, you know, bump in Yuri. So we started talking about that and started reviewing stuff, particularly stuff coming out from Japan, because here it's always been pretty thin in the U.S. and English, so I was really talking about all the stuff that people should be buying from Japan and what could potentially be out there of interest. And then it just kept going from there. So Okazu, which is the blog I'm talking about, basically is the oldest Yuri blog in the world.
Really? That's yeah. Surprising to me. Now, is that the genre it's not new per se, but would you say there's more material now than there was, say, in the 80s or 90s?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the amount coming out now is just, there's no question. There's a lot, you know, it's very hard to trace a specific day when Yuri began, because there's a lot of proto-Yuri that's in the late 60s. There's actually someone out there, Erin Subramanian, who does a lot more really old stuff, and she has a really amazing collection as well. But in 1971, a story was published called Our Right Room, Shiroi Heino Futari. And that kind of is seen by the modern Yuri audience as like the first Yuri manga. It has a lot of the tropes that you see over and over, you know, two girls in a Catholic school, private school, up in the attic. And it actually has some literary roots from a series in the 1920s, an actual Japanese novel called Two Maidens in the Attic, Yana Uru no Nishoujo. And so, you know, you get a lot of the same sort of tropes and stuff, but what you had from the 70s on was, you know, the occasional thing. You had Ryoko Okeda's Claudine, you had Rosa Versailles. In the 90s, you got Sailor Moon, and then, you know, that was mid-90s, and in 2000, you have Utena. So it was kind of like, you know, these dribs and drabs that people held on to. And as time went on, starting in 2003, things really shifted with Yuri Shimai. In 2005, they suspended publishing and another publisher bought the magazine, and it relaunched as Yuri Hime. 2005 was when we did YuriCon in Tokyo, and I was actually talking to some of the mangaka at the time, and my end speech was basically, it's up to you to make this happen. Call yourselves Yuri mangaka. Make the genre itself. And so 2005 is kind of the day it shifted. You know, it was quite literally that day. And Yurihime has really, really pushed Yuri manga into, you know, a section in the shelves in Japan. And we were trying to do that here in America. And I think while it's not being picked up, the buying audience is still pretty small. There's certainly a lot more material than there was. And then you have things like the anime, like Aoi Hana came out last year, because last year, of course, was an odd number year, 2009. And Crunchyroll picked that up. And you have like Maria Samagami Teru, which was launched by Right Stuff as Maria Watches Over Us. And so you have, you know, some other companies working on the anime side, and not so many on the manga, but Seven Seas is still working here and there. And, you know, I think there's just a tremendous amount of material out now that we're not even seeing yet. And hopefully we will.
Right. See, I'm not particularly familiar with the genre. I know very little about it. It's not something I've necessarily pursued. I think the first show I watched more than like two episodes of was that that one last year. I think it was from last season. It was the sort of girl crazy. I cannot remember the name of it. God damn it! With the she's got
was
the best.
Sasumeki Koto?
Yes, that's the one. Sasumeki Koto.
Sasumeki Koto is interesting because it came out at this in the same year as Aoi Hana, and Aoi Hana is written by a woman. It's written by Shimura Takako, who is a very well-known and well-respected manga artist, and her Wandering Sun is coming out, I guess it's now pushed back to February, but it's coming out this winter. And she's well-respected. She draws for an adult audience. She's drawing for a magazine called Manga Erotics F, which has a really mixed audience of both men and women. Uh-huh. And then you have Sasumeki Koto, which is being kind of almost a parody of the exact same trope. So you have Aoi Hana dealing with all the very, very typical tropes, the whole schoolgirl, private school thing, but dealing with it in a really realistic and beautifully done manner. And then you have Sasumeki Koto, which is like crazy and wild and has every trope. And really, the comedy, the manga is hysterical. It's very, very funny. He really, the artist who is a guy, just shoves every possible trope he could get into the series, and I really like that. It's quite funny.
Right, but to someone completely new to the genre, and being under the impression that Yuri titles, I mean, maybe this is just my misconception of it, but it's not as exploitative as Yaoi is. It's not as over the top. It's certainly not quite as pornographic. It's different.
You're definitely reading the wrong case. Everyone says that. It's funny. I think that's partially because of what comes over here.
I think so. Yeah. I think so. I mean, and especially because, you know, Revolutionary Girl Lieutenant is probably my favorite show of all time, my favorite anime of all time.
An excellent choice.
Yeah, and that's the Yuri elements are reserved for the most part. Yep. It's not super over the top, but that's pretty much been my exposure to it. And so that's a misconception that Yuri is not quite as, I don't know, raunchy as Yaoi generally is.
Well, you know, in the early part of the 1970s, there was early feminist movement in Japan. There was some gay pride movement in Japan. And you had a magazine called Barazoku, which was published until just a very, very few years ago. And it was for gay men. And they, at the time, they the editor, who was one of our guests at YuriCon 2005 in Tokyo, he actually was talking about the Rouge Tribe gay man and then the Lily Tribe, the lesbians, and the concept of the Yurizoku just went ballistic there, and almost immediately it was a meme that was taken by the guys writing porn, lesbian porn, so you have lilies everywhere and like everything, you know, for all eternity. And you had women primarily who were drawing Yuri for, you know, lesbian women drawing Yuri for other lesbians who really avoided the word altogether. So Yuri isn't as consistent and homogenous as Yaoi. Yaoi and BL are a very specific thing, whereas Yuri is more or less frequently an element in other things, so that you don't really have a single, you know, homogeneity. It's not there's, it's this, it's like everything, everywhere you go. I mean, it's in little kids stuff. I'm reading all three of the girls magazines, the main girls manga magazines of Japan, Chao, Ribbon, and Nakayoshi, all have stories that are Yuri right now. And they haven't actually in a really long time. But then I'm also reading seinen stuff, and I'm, you know, reading stuff for whoever the hell buys it. So it's not like as consistent where, you know, there's these specific magazines. You do have Yurihime, and now we have a few more Yuri anthologies. There's Hirari, Tsubomi, Shoujo Yuri. I'm sorry, Yuri Shoujo. And I believe there's one that's escaping me at the moment, but someone will correct me. And Yuri Monogatari, the thing that we publish. There's some anthologies that are specific, but there's not that kind of body of literature there is for BL.
Right. Yeah, exactly. And, you know, I've noticed that, like you mentioned, I'll see Yuri elements in a show that I wouldn't necessarily describe as being a Yuri show. But if there's Shonen Eye elements, it's hard not to classify it as being a Shonen Eye series.
Yeah.
It's sort of it's a little bit more subtle, I guess.
I think a lot of it has to do with the fact that Yuri can be for pretty much any audience who's interested in that series. You know, if you're watching something like Toaru Kagaku no Railgun, which is a Dengeki Daio Media Works series, and so the audience is primarily, you know, older teen to young 20 men, but it has some Yuri elements in it. And so it might be Yuri fans who are watching it. It might be men who are watching it. It might be, you know, hardcore, you know, Toaru Index fans, you know. And so it's kind of, it's less, as I say, it's less homogenous, whereas BL is very consistently for women by women, and you don't see too many, you know, the genre is what it is, and Yuri, you're going to get a lot of other things. But back to your point of, is there a lot of porn? Yeah, there actually is a tremendous amount of just lesbian porn by guys that are still, you know, calling itself Yuri, but you're seeing less and less of that as more women are stepping in and saying, you know, what we're drawing now here, this men and women, like the Yurihime stuff, Yurihime comics have a lot of different kinds of stories, but it's more for a Yuri audience. And so you are starting to see some of that kind of thing.
Now, that's interesting to me, because one of the biggest, one of my biggest criticisms of yaoi, I don't have a problem with it per se, but one of the things that bothers me about it is the generally exploitative tone, and the fact that I don't think I've ever seen an example of a popular or well-known yaoi manga that was actually written by a gay man, written for a homosexual audience that could identify with it. Like, these aren't, it's not like, it's exploitative. It's leery. That bothers me.
I mean, that's the bottom line, and there's really no other way to look at it other than that.
Yeah, I guess so. But you're saying that women are sort of stepping in and taking over the genre. Is that...
Well, what's happening with... First of all, in Japan, you're talking about a couple different things. First of all, the whole exploitative, you know, the whole rape and the whole seme-uke thing. There's that, a plenty of that in Yuri. I mean, like, just tons and tons and tons. And it depends on what you're reading. If you're reading something like Yurihime Wild Rose, you're looking at almost exactly the same kind of thing, just with two women. It's just that you're not seeing that coming over here, maybe. What you've got in terms of the uke-seme dynamic is you've got Japanese sort of partially. It's things we'd like to see that we're not going to see, you know. So you've got this kind of, you know, acting out space. Partially you've got a reflection of the actual dynamics where there's just a tremendous separation between men and women and certain gender roles, which, of course, you know, everything I'm about to say and everything I've said is kind of very extreme, you know, because you're looking at a fantasy space. Mm-hmm. So the kinds of things that are being done are, you know, extreme. Normal humans don't necessarily have those kinds of extreme behaviors because it's a fantasy space. But you do see that in Yuri, absolutely. It's just what's happening now is you've got artists who've been drawing Yuri for women artists particularly, but also guys, drawing for a really long time. I mean, they've been drawing Yuri as doujinshi artists and independent artists for, you know, 10, 15 years. And they're willing to do a couple of goofy stories, and then they want to go do the stories they want to go do. Hmm. And there's a pretty high level of maturity among the artists, which is really interesting. And I've done some interviews with a few of them, and you're looking at people who are telling stories that 20 years ago, you wouldn't have seen in any genre.
Interesting. Interesting. But to that point, do you think there's a lack of material for a sincere, serious audience that's looking to identify with stories about homosexual people?
Well, the Japanese artists in both the gay men basically have their own genre for themselves. It's okay. Called bara, and it's like bears. Here we'd call them bears here. Yeah. So it's a different thing. It's not yaoi. It's not BL. There are men who read BL, absolutely. I don't honestly know of any male mangaka who is drawing BL, and it's not true. I lie. I absolutely have. Rakuin Le Paradis has a male mangaka who is drawing BL stories, mostly shota. Hmm. And it's fascinating because the art is really distressing. It's really interesting stuff, so I lie. So even that's changing. But you do have women, lesbians who are drawing for themselves, were drawing what they call Bion work, which they still do call Bion, which is short for lesbian. Hmm. Rezu in Japanese is sort of like lesbo, right. So they avoid that. Mm-hmm. But Yuri was so much for the creepy fanboys that they avoided that for years. But now they're starting to shift over, and a lot of the folks that I know who are doing beyond work are now Yuri mangaka, which is fascinating to me.
Yeah, that's
so the answer to that is no. I think there's a ton of stuff. Let me just say that the thing that I consider to be the best manga I'm reading currently is something called Gunjo. And I did an interview with Nakamura Ching, the mangaka. She's unbelievable, and the work is unbelievable, and it runs in Icky magazine. We haven't yet seen it over with Sig Icky. Mm-hmm. I'm honestly not sure that they'd be brave enough to bring it over.
Tell me about it.
Gunjo is a story about a woman who has no name, and the longtime friend she has is a lesbian who is in love with her, who also has no name. None of the characters have any names, and the story starts right after the lesbian character has just killed the other woman's husband.
Whoa.
And at her request.
Yikes.
And the two of them head out on the road to run away from the law. And it is a very brutal, very violent, very dark, very dysfunctional, absolutely fantastic series.
Sounds interesting.
It's absolutely the best thing I've ever read, period.
Wow. Huh.
Hopefully, love is to bring it over in Sigiki, but I really just don't see it happening.
Yeah, I mean, I like the Sigiki stuff, but they're definitely sticking to the pretty lightweight fare. I didn't even know Icky had anything that was that heavy in it. I'm used to seeing, like, Saturn Apartments, and I'll try and give it my best tomorrow or whatever.
Oh, God, yeah. I mean, Icky's got a lot. I mean, I realize it's a cognate, but I got to tell you something that's really well-named, because every time I go to I sit down with Icky, I have to take a deep breath. And I have to kind of go, okay, I describe Gunjo as eating the most delicious razor blades you've ever had. And the whole magazine is a little like that. It's a little bit like cutting. I mean, it makes you feel really good when you're done.
Wow. Okay. That's all right. Interesting. So what else out there are you? Do you tend to stick to your niche? Do you read everything you get your hands on? What other stuff are you into?
I read everything. I read everything that doesn't move. I focus on the niche on Okazu and on, you know, the Yurikon website, but I read just about everything. So, I've been following, you know, Pluto, and I've been following a bunch of other, you know, English language stuff, all of the Tezuka stuff out by Vertical. In fact, I have a deal with my local library. I buy them, blackjack, and just give it to them when I'm done. I pretty much read just about anything anyone hands me. I just finished After School Nightmare for the manga Movable Feast, which is a very loose confederation of the manga bloggers. Twitter's been an amazing thing for the manga bloggers. We've all been able to really get together and have conversations. You might have seen the recent Axed analysis that Debaoki and David Walsh were doing. No. With anybody else who wanted to jump in and talk about the Axe anthology. And it's just been Twitter's been a really, really interesting process. It's also brought me in contact with a lot more of the Yuri artists, and a lot of other manga artists, And so it's very, very interesting because I can actually see what they're watching and what they're writing and what they're talking about, what they're reading. So that's kind of interesting. But I pretty much read just about anything I can get my hands on. I read very, very widely. On Okazu, I keep focused to Yuri because there still aren't a whole lot of people talking about it.
Right. Well, you've got your sort of stock and trade, and then you've got your hobby stuff.
Yeah.
So, exactly. Right. So in terms of what's out there right now, I mean, the manga industry obviously is having some trouble, like every other industry in the world right now. What do you see out there happening right now? What are the trends you see happening? And what do you think the future holds for manga in America?
There was actually an article today that was linked on Twitter about the economics of publishing. It had nothing to do with manga. It was talking about book publishing. Mm-hmm. And what they were talking about was how the shift to going digital certainly cuts down costs for publishers, but it kills their print audience because it cannibalizes their own audience. Mm-hmm. And what they were talking about was basically how if digital becomes popular, it becomes less likely that print can pay for itself. And that is pretty much where I think a lot of the manga companies are right now, where yes, the shift to digital would make a lot of sense financially, but what it does is it keeps them from being able to make any money in the print. There's a certain critical mass you have to make of books to make it worthwhile to print books at all. Mm-hmm. We can't print 500 books. It doesn't make any sense fiscally, you know? And so it's nice that, you know, you're the one of 10 people who go, well, I won't buy that online. And it's like, well, but we can't afford not to put it online, but we can't afford to give it to you in print anymore. So I think right now, this is what I've been saying for a while, we're in a pre-Gutenberg space. There's no one format. There's no one process, and everyone's sort of flailing a little bit. And the fans, of course, are working on technology that's faster and better and more demanding, and their expectations are much, much more unrealistic because they're going, well, we can do this without having to have any delays. And it's like, well, yeah, that's because, you know, you're stealing the stuff to get it. And it makes sense not to have to worry about, you know, all the delays that go along with actually publishing. So what you have in the manga industry right now is the largest audience manga has ever had and the smallest market in comparison. The percentage of people willing to actually pay for what they want to read is smaller than it was in, you know, years gone by. I mean, when we first, I'm sure it's the same with you, but I know I've been doing this for a long time, and there was a time where we all would have loved to have this much stuff and we'd love to pay for it, you know. But there were like three anime over here and no manga.
You know, it's funny to me. I was thinking about this the other day because there's a great comedian, Louis C.K., has a bit about how technology we didn't know existed, 5 minutes after we have it, we'll start complaining that it's not fast enough or good enough.
That's absolutely right. That's absolutely right.
And that seems to me like that's what happened to manga and anime. We didn't have access to it. Suddenly we had access to all of it. And the minute we're asked now when we're asked to wait or pay for it, we instantly start bitching.
Yeah.
And
absolutely.
That seems like that's really been crippling for the,
yeah, I have to say that's one of the things I focus on a lot at Okazu. And I have to tell you that, I did a poll a while back, and even given the fact that people will lie about things, you know, just to make themselves feel better, I have about a 70% of the readers of my blog buy what they want. And I even the Japanese stuff, and I can see because they're going through my links, so I can see what they're buying. They buy a ton of stuff. And so, you know, it's one of the things I've really, really focused on is not only supporting the industry in Japan, the industry here in America, but also, like, one of the things that I really encourage people doing is I read a lot of American manga and then immediately go and donate it to my library. You know, all the stuff, everything translated, because I don't really want to keep it.
Right.
Because I prefer to keep the Japanese stuff. It's more of a bang for my buck. It takes me a month to read a volume. It takes me, you know, 40 minutes to read one in English. So
I'm sure
rather, you know, give that. So, I mean, I literally donated all of One Piece, like 59 volumes of One Piece to them. And they were like, like, we don't even have space for this.
Yeah.
But a lot of my readers are doing that now, too. And that to me is really pretty extraordinary, that the percentage of readers that I have that buy what they want is very, very high.
Yeah, that's really cool. I think that's also an anomaly.
Yes. Well, I mean, I really do focus on it very heavily on Okazu, and you know, it's one of the things I think my fans have really responded to well.
Yeah. Do you think that, I mean, you're obviously doing what you can. Do you think there's a strategy when you're talking to younger fans who never buy anything? Is there a way to approach these people that they're not going to immediately dismiss or tell you that you're being a Nazi or whatever?
That's a really good question. What I've learned is one of the reasons I do interviews with some of the manga artists is it makes them more real.
Yeah, it makes them human. Yeah.
As soon as you stop thinking of a manga artist being something, some monster, some computer, some, you know, thing over there in some country you'll never hear of, the one thing that drives me crazy is when fans still call it moon language. I just jump right all over them. You know, it's just a language that humans speak. When you start making the process real, you say, this is what I had to do today to bring you this. You know, this is what had to happen. And I think the more you start being transparent and trying to get them involved, like, okay, you think this is real easy, you do it and then see what happens. And one of the things that I do, I'll be involved at the end of next month with Manga Next. Mm-hmm. And I do some talks there about how to talk to publishers, how to approach them, you know, how you basically have three lines to impress. And the first line has to be, hello, my name is, and I'm writing to you about. So that leaves you two to be really great and you know, intelligent and professional and competent. And the other thing that's going to happen there is Leah Hernandez is actually going to be doing a manga boot camp where you're going to be stuck in a room drawing for hours. So you can kind of feel like really what kind of level of commitment and work has to go into a project. And it's not the same as updating your web comic once a month or something. I think as soon as you start really getting into the nitty gritty and really being transparent, people start to respond to that.
Maybe it would be extra effective if they somehow figured out a way to make everyone in the room's muscles atrophy while they're drawing. So one thing I have noticed, and it is about humanizing the artist and the process, but I've noticed there's a real toxic relationship right now between fans and artists, at least what I've seen on, especially on our forums. People are basically just like, shut up and dance for me, monkey. I don't care if you don't make a living. Make my cartoons and my comic books and shut up. And that's what do you do about that? Like, I don't even know where to start other than telling them to go fuck themselves. I really don't.
Yeah. And, you know, and I've been reading ANN forums for years, and that's always kind of been where we've gotten. I mean, the ANN forums is very much the audience without being the market. I mean, that's, you guys have got that one wrapped up. Part of it is just, it's emotional and chronological immaturity. A 14-year-old just doesn't really care, really honestly doesn't care. And a 34-year-old who has to work every day is going to care more because we've had work and we've had it stolen and we know what it feels like, you know? And so there's a certain difference there. You know, but you can't make people smart and you can't fix them. You can point out the obvious that if you keep stealing and nobody buys this stuff, then it goes away. And you know, I'm so conflicted with the whole thing. I understand why I wrote this really long post called the solution to the Scanlation solution, where I detail why Scanlation started and why they were a great idea at the time and why they're an elegant solution, but they're failing on a lot of levels now. And it frustrates me because as a Yuri fan, there's so much coming out in Japan right now that will never get over here. And partially because the audience there's the audience thinks it's got another zero at the end of the amount of people there are. They think there's like 50,000 people out there.
Yeah.
And just, you know, there isn't. I mean, there isn't, even in terms of the amount of people who are downloading porn, there just isn't that many people. And the audience is, you know, an order underneath that, you know. And so, you know, when you're talking about only 2,000 people who will actually cough up for a book, it makes it impossible to really jump in there and license stuff. I was going to do an event last year, and I thought, I'm going to do this event for the same 100 people who always show up.
Right.
Yeah. You know? I mean, it is very disheartening to know that there's plenty of people who want a thing, but very few people of that who will pay for that thing. And so, I understand where Scanlations come from because I'm still working in a genre that's incredibly underserved, but it's underserved because they're downloading Scanlations. So it's this horrible, you know, welter, you know, this thing, this unending cycle of it's never going to work. Well, you know, a friend of mine from Japan actually said some months ago. He said, you know, Japan manga culture is 60 years old. He said, until 10, 15, 20 years ago, it was like that here, too. You were a manga fan, and if you were a manga fan after you were 13, you were a joke. There wasn't anything for you. And now, you know, I'm looking at magazines that are for men, for women, for kids, but then there's magazines for just manga fans like Comic Beam and Icky and Mooring 2 and just all these Rocco and La Paradis, just these crazy, wacky magazines that 15 years ago you would never, ever have seen. You know, there wouldn't have been something for people who just like comics. And so, you know, I think we need to give it time. More than anything, we just have to just shut up and wait. The manga industry here is what, if we really stretch, what is it, maybe 15 years old, and that's going back down to like the absolute earliest ones.
Yeah.
20 years from now, none of this will be an issue. The format wars will have settled down. We'll have our Gutenberg press, and we'll have our answers. What I fear more than scanlations killing the industry, the thing I fear is the hardware gods. You know, here's Steve Jobs telling us that he's protecting the world from porn, and then you can't get comics with any LGBT content at all on an iPad.
Really?
Yeah, they completely just reject them all. They rejected a Pulitzer Prize winner, and then it wasn't until somebody said, duh, they won a Pulitzer Prize that they let that comic on. They rejected a comic based on Oscar Wilde, The Importance of Being Earnest. I mean, the bottom line is that we do not want the hardware makers making the decision about the content.
Yeah, no, that's horrible.
That worries me because everyone's so into the iPad and the Kindle, but you know what? Seriously, do we want Amazon making those decisions? Do we want Apple making those decisions? That is what worries me more than a bunch of kids, you know, chronologically or emotionally stealing something they were never going to pay for in the first place.
Yeah, boy, you're right. That is very dangerous. I wasn't aware it was that insane. In terms of censorship on the iPad, that's ridiculous.
Yeah, you should look because Jason Thompson actually did a really nice discussion of why the e-readers out there really don't serve graphic work at all well. And then, like, the week after Apple rejected the Pulitzer Prize winning, you know, graphic novel.
Yeah, yeah. Going back a little bit to the relationship between the fan and the artist, do you think that it's, I mean, arts appreciation is one of those things that unless you're taught it in school or have a natural predilection towards the arts or somehow have an education in the arts or something like that, it's not normal for somebody to be that sympathetic towards an artist or really understand how much work goes into it. Do you think that's part of the disconnect between the fan who just wants to read his comics and shut up, you artist, I don't care if you get paid? Do you think it's an artist appreciation thing that they just don't get it?
I think there's that. I think there's a certain amount of just a culture of entitlement, which I think everybody has talked about.
Yeah.
There's a total disconnect from the entire process. And you're talking about a lot of people who are in college and they haven't had their full-time job where they have any IP of their own. I think anybody who's worked with any kind of creative work of any kind, writing or music or even coding, to be very honest, I think will understand better what it means when you say, well, that didn't take you any time at all. You know, it's like, you're right, it didn't, but it also took me 25 years to get to the point where it no longer takes me any time to do this. You know, so I think there's a certain amount of disconnect there. I think, you know, it could be very much the anonymity of the internet. So, you know, they're all going, well, I don't care what I say. This is not even my real name. No one knows that it's me. I could say whatever I feel like, you know, and there's a certain amount of that. And there's a certain amount of just, I don't know, geek negativity. I don't know what it is, but I see it in every fandom. It's not just anime. It's not just manga. I mean, every fandom where it's like the loudest, most ridiculously idiotic people seem to rise to the top because they just don't shut up. In the real world, if somebody stood in the middle of the room screaming their lungs out, you know, this party sucks, everyone would escort them out the door. But online, nobody ever does.
Yeah, I tend to describe the geek culture as they're fans of complaining. you know, that's pretty much, I mean, a new Spider-Man movie comes out, there's, you know, 100 million pages of complaining, but it grosses $400 million domestic. So,
yeah, if you really want to get an idea of what happens when you get anything gets popular of any kind, you know, go and look up anything sucks on Google and pick anything, whatever it is, pick, you know, anybody or anything. Stephen Colbert sucks. And go and look at the number that comes up. And so there's a, you know, because you'll get like Britney sucks and it's like 18 billion responses on Google. And you think, none of these people know this woman. They don't know who she is. What does that even mean? You know, I mean, how does it, how could she suck? I mean, how many people has she met? The woman's practically a hermit at this point, you know? And so there's a certain amount of jealousy that's involved. There's complaining. There's just cluelessness. I mean, there's just so many things, which is why I focus so strongly on Okazu, because I want my readers not to be all that. And yeah, by and large, I believe they are not.
Just focus on positivity. You know, I was thinking about this the other day, that for our generation, for our society right now, the tipping point is when people decide that they can act in real life the way they do on the internet. And we're already seeing little hints of this happening at anime conventions. And mm-hmm. I think we are set for bedlam and apocalypse if that tips over and people decide, you know what, I'm just going to act in real life how I do on the internet.
You know, I have to say that I think I'm not worried about it at anime conventions, but there are some political things out, movements out there that distrust me deeply, because you've got that same exact thing going on. That actually really worries me. You know, I mean, forget anime and manga. That's just comics and cartoons. And that's the other thing. I think having a good perspective of this, we all get to, I mean, you know this, we all get so wrapped up in this. You know, we're all sitting around like, you know, doing this 24/7, and like we're doing these long nights. And, you know, I've watched Justin post how he's, you know, he's been encoding videos for 28 hours straight.
Yeah.
You know, we all lose perspective. And the important thing is to remember that if this isn't fun, we really, really shouldn't be doing it.
Well, I mean, it is my full-time job, so it's a little more than just fun.
You know, I mean, you know, if I didn't like my full-time job, I'd walk away.
Oh, true. Oh, for sure. I love my job. My job's awesome. But yeah, you know, I get exactly what you're saying. Okay. Well, before I let you go, anything you want to plug?
Anything I want to plug? Yeah, there was something, and now I've completely forgotten about it, so I guess I'm not going to plug anything at the moment. I will say that if you're interested, if anyone out there is interested in understanding what it's like to work in, quote-unquote, the industry, because lots of people say they want to be in the industry, really try to make an attempt to get over to Manga Next, where there's going to be artists who are in comics, American comics, and illustration, who are doing web comics, who are doing manga, independent manga. Publishers are going to be there. You're going to see the whole gamut of what the industry looks like. And I think that that will give you a better clue as to what you're talking about when you say you want to work in it.
Yeah, I think once a lot of people realize just how difficult it is and how much work it is. I mean, creative professions are some of the hardest jobs in the world, really, to get into and to keep.
And to make a living at. I mean, how many people do you know, and I'm sure you can name a number right off the top of your head, who are really well-known creative people who still have to have a day job?
Very few. Yeah. Okay, dude, well, listen, thank you so much. That was great. Thank you. Thank you so much for coming on. Okay, finally, we're going to talk about the new season of anime, which starts about when this podcast is going to hit. With me is Scott and John from the Otaku in Review podcast, which you can check out over at otakuinreview.com. Hey, guys.
How you doing, Zach?
Not so bad. I am pretty good. It's fall preview time, it's 12-hour days for me. Because I'm editing and posting the work of six different people 24 hours a day. But people really like it, so I get to kill myself doing it.
I was thinking about doing your style of fall previews on my own blog, and just doing mine scares me, so I don't envy you.
Yeah, I mean, I blow off steam by reviewing the shows myself sometimes.
Oh, yes.
we know.
So, I gotta ask, what do you guys think? Have you looked over the chart? What are you looking forward to the most? I guess I'll start with John.
I'm actually looking forward to quite a few shows. Well, I'm definitely willing to check out a lot of them. Whether or not I'm going to keep up with them, that's another question. But there's definitely a lot of second seasons this upcoming season that I'm definitely looking forward to. To Love Ru, Index, Sora no Toshimono, and there's some new shows coming out too that I'm also looking forward to. So, pretty good. I noticed we're seeing some new mecha shows coming out,
finally. So that's a nice thing to be looking forward to as well. So,
anything specific?
Oh, yeah. Well, let's see. While we're on the mech guy, I'm definitely going to be checking out Star Driver. It's by Bones, so it's probably going to have good animation. Story, you know, it just sounds like you're kind of generic, but I'm okay with that. I mean, I think I can definitely find enjoyment in that show. I am going to check out, I don't know if I'm going to keep up with it, but Panty and Stocking with Gardebelt, as ridiculous as that title seems, I am willing to at least check that out because the art style looks pretty interesting. Some of the others that stand out a bit more than, well, The World God Only Knows is one of the shows that everyone's talking about. I've read a little bit of the manga, and it is pretty funny. So I will definitely be checking that out. It's going to be on Crunchyroll. So
what is that about?
Basically, this guy is really good at dating sim, visual novel, those types of things, and he calls himself like the capturing god. He can capture any 2D girl, which isn't really that hard if you ask me. But basically, he runs into this demon spirit girl, whatever, that challenges him to try to fall in love with real girls. So it's pretty interesting, pretty unique premise. Very funny from what I read of the manga. So, yeah, like I said, very, very much looking forward to that.
Hmm. Sounds kind of interesting. And what about you, Scott?
Yeah, as John said, it seems to be the season of sequels, and none of the sequels intrigue me because I didn't see the original shows. Panty and Stocking looks interesting. It's just for the art style because it's so different from what Gainax has done in the past. And it's a Gainax show, and they haven't done anything bad. Although I didn't see Hatamari Kindergarten, and I didn't hear that was very intriguing. Definitely Bakuman, because I've heard good things about the manga. It's by Oba and Obata, who did the Death Note manga. So, you know, that was one of the most intriguing dramas we'd seen in anime in a long time. So it's,
yeah, that's another show I've heard quite a bit about is Bakuman. I have a lot of friends who are into the manga, and I will definitely be checking that out as well.
There's a lot of people that say Bakuman's like really misogynist.
While I'm researching for this, I came across a post by Debo Aoki at manga.about.com that kind of pointed that out. And I don't know. I haven't read any of it. So I guess we'll see in the first episode if they carry that over.
Yeah, I have no idea. I'm intrigued by that one too. I think it looks kind of interesting. I mean, at this point, like, it seems like half of the shows every season are about people who make doujinshi or whatever. It's all manga art shows about manga artists, and I don't know. I didn't realize manga was getting quite so, I don't know, up its own ass.
Well, the way Deb described it was interesting. She said it was a shonen quest style show, but the goal is not to be the best fighter; it's to become a mangaka. So it's got that familiar style, just with a completely different plot line.
I feel like I've seen that before.
Oh, okay.
I feel like I've seen that story done before. Maybe Comic Party is a little similar. But okay. That was more of a romance, I think. But anyway, yeah, I don't know. I'm the things that are intriguing me are Panty and Stocking. Originally, I saw the premise for it and said, "No, fuck this. This is not going to be my kind of thing." But then I saw the trailer and was like, "Oh, well, they're actually trying. Like, they're actually trying to make something really different." And it looks interesting. I'll check out the first episode for sure. And what's the other thing? Oh, this Kurage Hime that's airing at the No Yahamine block. It's about a illustrator moves into a building full of Fujoshi, and one of them is a dude, and hijinks ensue, I guess. That could be funny. I don't know.
Yeah, maybe.
And then there's Iron Man, of course. But Todd Sealick reviewed that for us at San Diego Comic Con, and he said it sucked.
I heard that. Yeah, I heard that they showed a trailer at San Diego Comic Con and it was not received well. Or so.
No,
they showed
the first episode, and he said he said it was crap. So that it was because the whole point of that project is to introduce Marvel characters to a Japanese audience in a fashion that will appeal to a Japanese audience, and so they just sort of tacked a bunch of anime tropes onto Iron Man. Which doesn't sound great to me.
And they have a 3-series deal, don't they?
Four.
Madhouse and Marvel?
It's 4, yeah. This is the first one.
Four.
They're doing this. There's a Wolverine one. I I can't remember what the other two are. I know they're doing a Wolverine, which, yawn. I'm not a Wolverine fan. There's a whole lot of Moe stuff, as usual. If you look at the bottom of the usual chart, there's sort of a row of pink.
Yes. But John, you want to watch a show from that block, don't you?
Yeah, I was going to say, John, you're a fan. Which of these looks good?
From the pink row that you're speaking of, I assume you're referring to the one with My Little Sister Can't Be This Cute, MM, Fortune Arterial, and Hentai Opera Milky Holmes. Only one of those shows I'm actually kind of looking forward to, and you're going to cringe a little bit at this, Zach, but My Little Sister Can't Be This Cute, I'm kind of want to check that out. I don't know why. I think the character design is kind of cool. I saw the trailer look kind of interesting, so as generic as it sounds, I mean, all right, basically it's about this guy discovers that his sister is into lots of porn hentai games and stuff. And so it seems that she's basically an otaku. And it seems kind of sounding like that anime that aired a few years ago, Nogizaka Haruka. If anyone's familiar with that title, I watched it. It was terrible. But it kind of seems like it could end up like that. But I don't know. I'm going to give this at least one episode, maybe two or three, actually, because it looks interesting.
It sounds a lot creepier when you say the Japanese title.
Okay. You want me to say the Japanese title? Orai no imoto ga konani kawaii wake ga nai.
Okay.
That is the ridiculously long Japanese title for this show.
Yeah, interesting.
And other shows in that row. I actually went over on the Otaku Interview podcast. I pointed out how two of the shows, MM and Fortune Arterial, look at the artwork in this chart here. The characters, they look exactly the same.
Blonde with a red school uniform.
Yeah. They're not really trying very hard on this.
Yeah. So, but yeah, that's the only of those four shows that I want to check out of the Moe shows, at least this season. I'm not, I might watch Shinryaku Ika Musume because that's on Crunchyroll. I wasn't going to watch it, but now that it's on Crunchyroll, I'll give it a shot. Yosuga no Sora definitely looks good to me. That looks like it has Ki potential, and I know a lot of people hate Ki, but I love Ki.
It looks like it has incest potential. That's what makes me kind of want to avoid it. It's about siblings who lose their parents and they go live in a rural area with their grandfather. And from the trailer, it looks like the female is obviously a tsundere and the male is passive and there's probably going to be some kind of incest. But it is directed by Taiko Takahashi, the director of Spice and Wolf. And I liked what he did with the romance in that series, kind of the slow build up and the romance that isn't quite a romance. So that might, despite the creepiness, I might enjoy that.
You said that's a Ki show. Is it based on a game?
Well, it's not a Ki show. I'm just saying it has Ki potential, and looks like it could become possibly the next Clannad. But yes, it is based on a game. It's based on an eroge dating sim. I don't know if it's a dating sim, but it is an eroge.
Wait, so that's not just incest potential.
Oops, I didn't know that part.
If it's based on an eroge, that's what that is.
Well, they usually take that stuff out when it gets adapted into an anime. So
true. I always just anyway. Do you guys watch the Index shows, the certain Railgun and, those shows?
I am actually a big fan. I like the first season of Index. It definitely hit a few bumps in the road along with, the presentation of its plot and its pacing and stuff. Some arcs definitely dragged on for a bit too long. But overall, I love it was a great fantasy story. It definitely had its otaku appealing elements that would definitely turn off some people. But love the character designs. It was by JC staff. They're a great production company. I mean, they made Toradora, so you can't really go wrong with most of what's by them. I'm definitely looking forward to the second season of that. Railgun, which aired recently, is the spinoff based on the manga spinoff series of Index, and that was also fantastic.
Yeah, I don't know. I've heard those were pretty quality for being, a bunch of girls with magic powers shows. Funimation licensed those, so I'm kind of looking forward to whenever those DVDs show up. I'll check it out. I try to be a little open-minded about these sorts of things. I predict that this Psychic Detective Yakumo show is going to be the most boring thing next to Letter B Reverse. The premise is just like, he's got one magic eye and he can see ghosts. and it's his job to like solve their murders or whatever and send them along in the spirit world, which again, it feels like I've seen that story before.
It's D. Gray Man with less action.
Unless
I watched like the first two episodes of the first season of Letter B, and yeah, it was boring as hell. It was just throwing the plot in all types of places. I couldn't keep up with it, and it was really putting me to sleep.
Well, the manga is beautiful, but you can read it at your own pace. You don't have to sit there and watch them slow pan across a background. Yeah, that gets kind of old. This Togainu no Chi thing. This is a yaoi thing, right?
Yeah, it's based off a yaoi game, I believe.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I'm gonna scrub that off my list.
It's I think it's like, remember Weisskreuz? Pronounced as Weib Cruz or White Cross from like 10 years ago. It was huge at the time, but it was Pretty Boy Assassins. Who owned a flower shop? Not ringing any bells.
No.
Anyway, it reminds me of that. I guess some of our listeners will know what I'm talking about.
It's deceptive because the description sounds like Darker Than Black. It's an assassin working for a syndicate in a post-apocalyptic world. I guess you could throw yaoi in there.
There's always a way to shoehorn in the yaoi.
Oh yeah,
just a little bit.
They're very good at that.
Sneak it in from behind.
Great. Thanks for that.
Yeah, you're welcome.
Well, anyway, so I don't know. Maybe it'll be a good season. Maybe it won't. What else is new with you guys? What have you guys been up to?
Preparing for New York Anime Fest.
Oh, right. Yeah, unfortunately, I can't be there for that. But yeah, that should be a good time. You guys are looking forward to it?
Very much. I've been researching cheap ways to get audio done and failing, actually.
Oh, okay. Interesting.
But other than that, I'm very excited. Yes.
Yeah, I'm also very much looking forward to it. They got some great guests this year. I know me and Scott are both very much looking forward to the Hatsune Miku concert.
Yes.
I mean, regardless of whether or not she's fake. But I'm sure it'll be a great concert.
And the disappearance of Haruhi Suzumiya is going to be played there, too.
Yes. I've heard nothing but good things about the movie, and I still have not seen it myself because I refuse to watch a cam rip. So I will definitely be watching that. Also looking forward to Minoru Chihara, the voice of Yuki from Haruhi.
Oh, yeah.
She's going to be having a concert there, autograph signing, so lots of good stuff this year at NIAF, and yeah, we will both be there, so if you're going to NIAF, look for us.
What's fun for us, we can spam Twitter with announcements, is that Crunchyroll's announcing its fall season there.
Oh, yes.
So
they have a panel. They have a panel there, yes.
That should be pretty exciting.
Interesting. Okay, cool. Well, have a good time. It seems like the entire blogosphere goes to NAF. But then again, I've noticed that most of the blogosphere, anime and manga, is East Coast-based. Not a whole lot of us on the West Coast.
Yeah, that's weird. I've noticed that, too. I don't... Because most... The bigger conventions are on the West Coast, or generally. Because AX is, what, twice... You know, bigger than Otakon.
Yeah, it is. But not by that much. But I think... I don't know what it is. It just seems like... Especially the people who participate on Twitter all seem to be East Coast based, which I think it's just like me and Justin and like four or five other people that are West Coast.
Gia too. Gia's out there, right?
She just moved to Texas.
Oh,
so
you lost one.
Not anymore. Yeah. And have you guys been watching anything lately that has struck your fancy?
Occult Academy. It just wrapped up. I thought the ending was very well done. It's like while dealing with the science fiction aspects, they kind of fell on their face at the end. But because it was mainly a comedy series, I forgave it because the ending was very enjoyable.
I have a few issues with the ending, but I'll go into more detail with that on our Otaku interview next episode.
Right.
But yeah, it was overall, Occult Academy was still very good. It was enjoyable for the most part. What else have I been watching? I'm trying to think. I've been rewatching Maihime, one of my favorite shows. It's actually one of the first shows I got that got me into anime. So good action, lots of cute girls. So good stuff there. And I will soon be watching part two of Corpse Princess. I just finished part one, and I got a review up on my blog for anyone who wants to check that out.
It's also K-On, but I don't think Zach wants to hear about K-On. It's fantastic.
Yeah. It's getting a movie.
Oh, God, yeah. I'm sure it is. I've heard really mixed things about Corpse Princess. Like, I think Carl Kimlinger liked it, but I've heard a lot of people saying it's super boring or just doesn't go anywhere.
Yeah, it's definitely got some pacing issues. It's definitely not the best action show that is out there. Far from it. It's a decent show if you're looking for a little bit of light entertainment with some horror elements thrown into it.
Interesting. I would have popped that in, but with the preview guide looming, I just haven't been watching any anime. A lot of work. Okay. All right, guys. Well, that was great. Thanks a lot.
Yep. Thanks for letting us on.
Okay, that's our show. I want to thank everyone for joining us. Don't forget, subscribe to us on iTunes, and we'll see you all next week.